So I want to take up in March the 22nd, 1908. The state of Louisa is a state of continuous prayer and sacrifice and union with God. Continuing my usual state, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself and I seemed to see M and the other priest. The M is Monsignor, that's the bishop. Then a young man of divine beauty came and drew near me and gave me some food. And I prayed him to share the food that he was giving with me, with M and the others. So drawing near M, he gave him a good share of it, saying to him, I share my food with you, and you satisfy my hunger by giving me souls. Now, the only way you can satisfy the Lord's hunger or give him a relief is to give him souls. There's no other way. So he was pointing to the work which M wants to do, and also exciting him strongly in his interior by giving him impulses and inspirations. Then he shared it with others. In the meantime, a venerable lady came out, and those who had received food from the young man drew around her and asked her what my state was. Now, this is the bishop and the priests are asking this lady what state Louisa is in. In other words, they are looking for discernment. They have to make a decision because they represent the church. And the lady answered, the state of this soul is a state of continuous prayer. It's a state of sacrifice and of union with God. So three things. And while being in this state, she is exposed to all the events of the church, of the world, and of the justice of God. Why? Because she offered herself as a victim soul to God's justice. And she spends her time praying, repairing, disarming the justice and preventing chastisements as much as she can. So that's the way things are all suspended. On hearing this, Louisa said, I'm so bad. And yet they say this is my state. But in spite of this, I found myself near a little window up high. And from it, I could see all that was being done in the church. Now, if a person is called to the position that Louisa is in, it's never for yourself. If the Lord calls you to union with God, it's never just for yourself. It is that you will become a window for him to save souls. You become a channel for him. Okay, it's never just for yourself. Let's put it this way. You never become a teacher just for yourself, do you? You never become a musician just for yourself. It wouldn't make any sense, would it? You never become a nurse or a doctor just for yourself. You never become a mother or a father just for yourself. That wouldn't make any sense, would it? So neither does it make sense that you enter into a life of union with God and that you don't have a role in bringing souls to the Lord. It just doesn't make sense. Okay. So when somebody is called deeply into union with God, the Lord gives them vision. Now, by vision, I don't mean a vision. I don't mean a picture or an experience. They become a seer, S-E-E-R, is what they called it in the Old Testament. That is a person who can see through the future and they can tell what the future is saying. That is Isaiah 46:10. Isaiah 46:10. That the Lord reveals the future to his prophets. Also Amos 3:7. I've given you Amos 3:7 a number of times, haven't I? So in this little window up high, right, could you only get it in this high state of union with God? You don't get it in the lower states. There are lots of people at a very early stage of relationship with God in charismatic prayer groups who claim to get all kinds of visions and revelations and stuff, but you can claim a lot. So from it, she said, I could see all that was going on in the church and in the world. And that's what the Lord said was happening for her. And I could see the scourges that were about to fall. These are the chastisements she tries to stop. But who can tell them all? I move on so as not to be too long. Oh, she said, how I moaned and prayed. I would have wanted to tear myself to pieces to prevent all this. That's exactly what the priests were told. But all of a sudden, everything disappeared and I found myself inside of myself. So, March the 25th, 1908 is a very important message, and it's about discernment. Continuing my usual state, Blessed Jesus came for just a little and he told me, "My daughter, temptations can be conquered easily." I think you should underline that one, shouldn't you? "Because the devil is the most cowardly creature that can exist. And a contrary act, a contempt, a prayer are enough to make him flee." Isn't that fantastic? Now, a contempt is, excuse my language, get the hell out of here. Yeah. That's a contempt.
That's a good one.
Well, you're telling him where to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where he belongs.
Yeah.
That's why I said, excuse my language, as we don't use it in this context, which is the only context in which it should be used.
Yes.
In other words, telling the devil to go to hell.
Yes.
Okay.
Or to use holy water.
Sorry?
To use holy water.
Well, he says a contempt, so I illustrated that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A prayer you don't need illustrated.
Mm.
He said, these are enough to make him flee. In other words, it's actually very easy. In fact, he said, these acts render him even more cowardly than he is. And in order not to bear that confusion, as soon as he sees the soul resolute in not wanting to pay attention to his cowardice, he flees terrified. He's terrified of anybody who will be faithful to God. So the Lord is telling us we don't have too much excuses for giving in to temptations, isn't that it? Now, if the soul cannot easily free herself, it means that it is not only a temptation, but a passion rooted within the soul. That means that there's something inside of us that wants this thing. That's a different matter altogether. A temptation is something that comes from outside. But if it has a root inside, then you're in trouble. And this root tyrannizes her together with the temptation. Therefore, she's unable to free herself. And where there is passion, the devil has more strength to make fun. Isn't that strange?
Mm-hmm.
Very important information there. And that is, we've been told from volume one, this is volume eight, that we are to take ourselves on, that we're to push the ego aside, that we're to deal with sin, that we're to have mortification in our lives. And therefore, this problem should be less and less and less and less and less. Otherwise, the divine will can't take over. Because the divine will won't take over where the passions are ruling. You know the scripture for that, don't you? Hebrews 12:14, nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. And the spirituality of the divine will is the highest spirituality offered to the human race. So we can't insult God by holding on to stuff. We've got to get rid of anything that even remotely shadows sin. So March the 29th, 1908, peaceful souls are the delight of God. Why? Because God is peace. Jesus is the King of peace. And when Jesus was born, he offered peace to anyone who had goodwill. Do you remember? So this morning on coming, Blessed Jesus seemed to carry a black mantle. And drawing near me, he seemed to place me under it, saying, "In this way, I will envelop all creatures as within a black mantle." And he disappeared. Now we have to find out why it's black. "I remain concerned because of some chastisement," she said, "and I prayed him to come back, for I could no longer be without him. But I was as though bothered by that sight before. Then after much hardship, he came, carrying a cup filled with some liqueur." Liqueur, isn't that what you say? "He gave me some to drink." Now, she says elsewhere that she calls it a liqueur, but she doesn't know what it is. In other words, to her, it looks like that. "He gave me some to drink," and then he added, "My daughter, peaceful souls eat at my table and drink from my cup." You can't drink at a cup, can you?
Mm-hmm.
"And the divine archer does nothing but dart through them continuously, and no dart is wasted." They are darts of love. Okay. All of them wound the loving soul, and the soul faints, while the divine archer continues with these arrows, which now make her die of love and then bring her back to life of love. That's in the Song of Songs, chapter 2, verses 1 to 7. He brings me to his banqueting table, and his banner over me is love. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. We sing it, don't we? Song of Songs, chapter 2, verses 1 to 7. And from her wounds the soul shoots her darts, to wound the one who has so much wounded her. So a peaceful soul is the delight and the enjoyment of God. You don't say amusement. Amusement for us is a very negative word, isn't it? The joy of God. While with turbid souls, these are the ones all disturbed and have all kinds of problems and roots of passions and everything in them. If the divine archer darts through them, the darts are wasted by the soul, leaving him embittered and forming the diabolical amusement. Now you can use the word amusement. Can you see that?
Yes.
So I want to give you Philippians 3, verses 12 to 16. Philippians 3. Verses 12 to 16. So we come to April the 5th, 1908. I have a VIP on this one. Here the Blessed Mother tells us what she understands sanctity is. And I think we should listen to her. What do you think?
Yes.
So continuing in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself, within a garden in which I could see the Queen Mother placed on a very high throne. Now, when she says a very high throne, she means something very close to God. Because in the higher volumes, Louisa is actually taken into heaven, and she says to the Lord, "I see the saints and I see the angels, but I don't see our Blessed Mother. Where is she? Surely she's in heaven." And he said, "Ah, come." And she said that she had to go very, very deeply into the Blessed Trinity before she could even see Blessed Mother, before she could even see her. So a very high throne means way, way up and beyond any of the angels or the saints. It doesn't mean just a high throne over Louisa. Do you know what I mean? I yearned to go up there and kiss her hand. And as I tried to go, she came to meet me. Why? Because she's the humblest woman on earth. Giving me a smacking kiss on my face. That's very interesting, isn't it? In looking at her, I saw as though a globe of light in her interior. Now, that globe of light is the divine will. Okay? So I saw a globe of light in her interior, and within that light, there was the word fiat. Her fiat joined to God's fiat. From that word descended many different unending seas of virtues, graces, greatness, glory, joys, beauty, and everything that our Queen Mother contains as a whole. Everything was rooted in that fiat, and all of her goods took their origin from the fiat. O omnipotent, fertile, holy fiat, who can understand you? I feel mute. It is so great that I can say nothing, and therefore I stop here. Now, there's something vitally important there for us. And that is that Louisa saw that everything that the Blessed Mother had in terms of holiness and sanctity and gifts and everything came from her fiat. It will be the same with us. The more we say yes to the Lord, the more we give our fiat, the more he is able to rule in our lives and the more he's able to pour out his gifts in us. It's not told to us to tell us that she's an exalted being. It's told to us to tell us that the fiat makes this difference in our lives. So Louisa said, I looked at her with amazement and she said to me, my daughter, all of my sanctity came out from within the word fiat. So there you have it. I did not move even one breath, one step, one action or anything at all if not within the will of God. My life, my food, my all was the will of God. And this produced such sanctity, riches, glories, honours for me, not human ones now, but divine. Because the divine will gives you all the divine stuff. So, this is for us. The more the soul is united, identified with the will of God. So notice the union first and then the identification. The more she can be called holy, and she is loved more by God. So what is a definition of holiness? It is living in the will of God. Now, for people who are not in the divine will, it's doing the will of God with as much love and humility as possible. When you want to live in the divine will, it's living in the divine will. And the more she is loved, the more she is favored with God's gifts and graces, because her life is nothing but the product of the will of God. How can he not love her if she is his own thing? Therefore, one must not look at how much or how little he does, but rather whether it is wanted by God. Now that should be coloured. Because we are, whether we like it or not, influenced by the world's thinking. The world is all around us. And so the world says such and such a thing is a big project or that's a small project. That's a big thing or that's a small thing. That's a big action or a small action. And these writings, Jesus tells us, no. Something is big if it is done with the will of God and in the will of God and because it's the will of God. And it reaches its fullness when you do that with love and humility. That's the height of sanctity. That's it. You've arrived. And so that's why we have to try and do it all the time. So, in fact, the Lord looks more at something little if it is according to his will than at something great without it. That means that the smallest actions in our lives can be sanctified in a most extraordinary way. So that passage there about Our Lady explaining holiness, I think, is vital. Okay. So April the 8th, 1908, is also a VIP message about discernment. I was concerned because I wasn't able to receive Holy Communion. This is very important. And good Jesus, on coming, told me, "My daughter, I do not want you to be bothered by anything." Would you put a circle around the anything? And we'd say, but going to Mass is different. He says, anything. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Now, it's true that having communion is a great thing, but how long does the tight union, I love the way the expression is, the tight union with the soul last? It lasts a quarter of an hour at the most. Mm-hmm. But the thing you should cherish the most is the complete undoing of your will. Now, that is... Excuse me. That's our motto in Divine Will. Not my will, but thine be done. Okay. And if you're like any of the rest of us, you tell the Lord, you give him your will, and then you find yourself doing your own will. You know. We have to keep on giving it all the time. The complete undoing of your will in mind, because for one who lives in my will, there is tight union, not only for a quarter of an hour, but always, always. My will is continuous communion with the soul. So, not once a day, but every hour and every moment is always communion for one who does my will. Now you see it. What he wants is the 24/7, 365. That's what he wants. Any lover would want that, wouldn't he? So Louisa says, "I've gone through the most bitter days because of the privation of my highest good, thinking and fearing that my state might be a pretense. Being in bed," this is very interesting, because this is the first time she actually does the reflection that I would have done on day two of her life. "Being in bed without movement, without occupation until the coming of the confessor, and without that usual doziness," that means that she's going into deep prayer and ecstasy, "tormented me and martyred me so much to the extent of making me fall ill for the pain and the continuous tears." In other words, she's bored, silly. She's dying of tedium, wouldn't you? I'd get a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
So, more than once, I begged the confessor to give me permission and obedience to sit on the bed according to my habit. In other words, not to actually be in bed. And to do my work of tombolo. She used to do embroidery. I don't know why they call it tombolo. I don't know. If I were not dozy and if Jesus Christ had not pleased to let me share as victim, a victim soul, because we've a different meaning nowadays to victim. So if he did not let me share as a victim soul in one of the mysteries of his passion, but he continuously and absolutely prohibited it to me. So the priestess will not allow it. Rather, he added, this is very, very interesting now, the priestess Father Gennaro Di Gennaro, he added that this state of mind, although I was deprived of my highest good, was to be considered as a state of victim soul because of the violence and the pain of the privation itself and of the obedience. This means the priest has got the message at long last. Louisa hasn't. Now, she's been asking time out of number why I have all this privation and all the rest of it. And surely if I don't have Jesus coming all the time and I don't have these things happening, surely I've got to get back to work and all the rest of it. And the priest said, no, everything in your life is part of being a victim soul. Let me give it to you in a different example. If you're married and you have a family, whether you're sick or well, old or young, dying or otherwise, you're still married. In other words, no matter what happens to you in that state of life is that you're married and have a family. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So he's saying to her, no matter what happens to you, whether Jesus is coming or not coming, whether you're having a privation or you're having this or that, it's still a state of victim, and that is correct. So he has given her, the priest has given her the discernment at long last. And so what I've done there is put a VIP on that sentence. She got her answer from the priest, and that's what the Lord wanted. But that doesn't mean that Louisa won't have problems about it. I always obeyed, she said, but the martyrdom of my heart was constantly saying to me, isn't this a pretense? Where is your doziness? Where is your state of victim? And what do you suffer of the mysteries of the passion? Because she doesn't need a devil, does she? No, who's tempting her? Herself. And what what the Lord is illustrating for us is that we are the cause of most of our own problems. We even say that about one another. That man's his own worst enemy, isn't that? Or something like that. Okay. So she says to herself, get up, get up. Don't make pretenses. Work, work. Don't you see that this pretense will lead to your damnation? And you, don't you tremble? Don't you think of the terrible judgment of God? Don't you see that after so many years, she's lashing herself, isn't she? That you've done nothing but dig your own abyss from which you will never get out for all eternity. Oh God, who can say the ripping of my heart and the cruel sufferings that tormented my soul, crushing me and throwing me into a sea of pains. But darling, you brought it on yourself. The devil wouldn't do better, would he? But tyrant obedience did not even allow one atom of my will. Da-da. Now, this is volume 8. I don't know if you remember volumes 1 and 2, where Jesus taught her about obedience and told her that the purpose of obedience is to destroy your self-will. That was the very reason why communities gathered together and took vows of obedience so that they could grow in holiness quicker than not having them. Okay. And of course, it's only when you're told to do something you don't want to do or at a time you don't want to do it that you realise just what you've brought on yourself, the tyrant of obedience. May the divine will be done which disposes this way. So, while in the midst of these cruel torments last night, as I was in my usual state, her usual state now is this ecstasy, this what she calls her doziness. Okay. I found myself surrounded by some people who were saying, recite a Pater, Ave and Gloria in honour of Saint Francis of Paula. Now, I don't know that saint. who will bring you some refreshment for your sufferings. So she recited the three prayers, and she said, as I did so, the saint appeared, bringing me a little loaf of bread, and he gave it to me, saying, eat it. Now, don't forget, this is spiritual food. Okay. I ate it and felt all strengthened, because it's spiritual strength what she actually needs. And then I said to him, dear saint, I would like to tell you something. And he, all kindness, said to me, what would you like to say? And Louisa said, I fear very much that my state may not be the will of God. Listen. Now, she can't get Jesus to listen to all of this, because Jesus tells her rather quickly, it is my will, but she still has to go around the roundabouts. Have you ever tried to tell something simple to a person, but they are so determined to give you all the nitty gritty and to give you all the minutest details that even though you gave them the answer and the first line, you're going to have to listen for the next half hour. That's never happened to you, sure has it? Ta-da. And sometimes they do it on the phone and you want to put the phone as far out from your ear as possible. So she, since Jesus won't listen to her, she gets the saint to listen to her. I think that's rather interesting. So she said, listen, in the first years, she's going to tell them the whole story. In the first years of this illness, which occurred at intervals, I would feel our Lord calling me to become a victim. At the same time, I would be caught by internal sufferings and wounds such that externally it appeared as if I was having a fit. It's rather interesting because that's the first time she's explained that. Now I fear that it was my fantasy that produced these evils. And the saint said, the sure sign to know whether a state is the will of God is that the soul is ready to do otherwise, which Louisa always was. If she knew that the will of God was no longer that state, in other words, you're not attached to it. Not persuaded, Louisa added, but dear saint, I've not told you everything. You see, he's got to get the nitty gritty. Listen, he has to hear the confession. The first ones were at intervals, and then from the time when our Lord called me to continuous immolation, it's 21 years since I've always been in bed. And who can tell my tribulations? Sometimes it seems that he leaves me. He takes suffering away from me, the only one and faithful friend of my state. That's my state of victim. And I remain crushed without God and even without the support of suffering. And so doubts and fears that my state will not be the will of God comes in. And so the saint, all sweetness, said to her, I repeat to you, he's given her the answer, you see, but she's not satisfied with it. And she wasn't satisfied with any of the answers that Jesus gave her either. I repeat to you what I've said to you before. If you are ready to do the will of God, if you knew it, then your state is his will. Now, I very much feel within my soul that if I knew the will of God with all clarity, and Jesus has told her endlessly, I would be ready to follow this holy volition at the cost of my life. So I remained more tranquil. May the Lord be always praised. I'm sure the saint heaved a sigh of relief going back to heaven. So May the 3rd, 1908. Now, I love incidents like that because it shows you, Louisa, much more like us.
Yes, very human.
Yeah. Whereas if we saw her heroic up here all the time, willing all the time to take whatever came and not questioning anything, I wouldn't have any interest in her, to be honest with you, because I'd say there's no connection with us. It's when she's struggling and being a bit silly like this that I say, oh, yeah, it's all right. I can communicate with someone like this. And I think it's wonderful. Very few saints have been great enough to tell you their faults. In the Bible, we only had two, and that was Jeremiah and Paul. They're the only two. I mean, Jesus didn't have any, so he couldn't give us any. But it takes somebody very great to actually tell you their struggles and their faults. The rest of us try to put on the best view we have, and we try to let everybody think, you know, we're grand, thanks, and we're not having any struggles, thank you very much, and all the rest of it. And that's not the reality, is it? Everybody's struggling about something. So May the 3rd, 1908, the effects of the circulation of the divine will in the soul. So in other words, what does the divine will do inside of us? Continuing in my usual state, I felt our Lord near me for just a little, and he told me, my daughter, with the soul who does my will, My will circulates in her whole being like blood. Now, he's using the image of blood because we've got thousands of miles of blood vessels running all over our whole being. And the blood takes life to every part of our body. So that's why he's using that image. So she's in continuous contact with me, with my power, with my wisdom, my charity and beauty. So if we're in contact with that, then these attributes of God will be applied to us insofar as we can take them. And she takes part in all that is mine. As she no longer lives of her own volition, her will lives in mine. And as mine circulates in hers, her will circulates in all of my being. Isn't that incredible? And this is why Louisa can have such squabbles with Jesus. She's actually inside of him and he's inside of her. Her will circulates in all of my being and I feel her continuous contact. You see, this can only happen if there's no sin. If there's sin, this is not going to happen. The divine will won't be circulating around us. And as I feel touched by her continuously, you cannot understand how drawn I feel to love her, to favour her, to answer her in everything she asks. If I denied it, I would deny it to myself. Besides, all things considered, since she lives in my will, she asks for nothing but for what I myself want. This is what she wants, and this alone makes her happy for herself and for others, because her life is more in heaven than on earth. This is the fruit of my will produces, to beatify the soul in advance. I don't know if you colour it. You should. That's the whole thing that the Lord wants, to beatify us ahead of time, that you live heaven on earth. Okay? So May the 12th, 1908, we now have how the bad rich are destroying the poor. It's a bit unusual as one of these messages. Continuing my usual state, I was praying to our Lord that he would concede to put peace in the hearts of people. They're all in discord. And she said, the poor want to attack the rich. Okay. There is so much turmoil and there's a thirst for human blood. It seems that they themselves can no longer contain themselves. Now, I want to give you Luke 16. Do you remember the story of Dives and Lazarus? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you're talking about here. Luke 16, Dives and Lazarus, yeah. It seems that they themselves can no longer contain themselves. If the Lord does not put his hand in, we are already close to the chastisements which many times he has manifested. Then Jesus came for just a little and told me, my daughter, a just justice is mine. This is very interesting because we think of justice as punishment. We don't think of it as right and proper, if I can put it that way. Okay? Now watch this. The rich have been the first to give a bad example to the poor. They are the first to move away from religion. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
They are the first to go from fulfilling their duties to the point of feeling ashamed even to enter a church to attend Mass and perform their obligation. The poor have nourished themselves with the poisonous slobber of the rich. Okay? And have fed themselves well with the poison of their bad example. And with that same poison given to them, unable to contain it, they try to attack them and even to kill them. There's no order without subjection. That's very, very interesting. In other words, if you are going to have any kind of a society, starting with the family and with any grouping of human beings up to the government, there must be leaders and there must be people who accept the laws. Okay, that's what he means. There's no order without subjection. That means obedience to the law. And the people rebel against God, against the rich. The rich have subtracted themselves from God. And see, the rich is running the world, isn't it? And so the people rebel against God. They rebel against the rich and against everyone. The scale of my justice is full. I can no longer contain it. So I want to give you the letter of James, chapter 5, from verse 1, where he tells the rich to watch out, you know, that the Lord is going. Chapter 5, from verse 1. So May 15th, 1908, she sees wars and revolutions. Again, I want to give you Isaiah 46:10 and Amos 3:7, that the Lord shows everything to the prophets ahead of time.
Amos 3:7.
As I was in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself in the midst of revolutions. It seems that they are ever more obstinate in wanting to shed blood. You see, it's 1908 and they're building up to World War I. That's what she's seeing. And you see, around the world leading up to World War I, there were all kinds of wars. There was the Boer War in South Africa, and there was wars in different places around the world. So she sees this. That's what she means by wars and revolutions actually going on. I prayed to the Lord and he told me, my daughter, men are preparing two storms. I've just given you that in English as distinct from the way it's written. One against the government and the other against the church. We would say two revolutions or two attacks. He said two storms. In the meantime, I seem to see fleeing leaders, the king at risk of being taken a prisoner. That's the king of Italy. And she'll tell you more about him as well. Because when they actually kill him, she's allowed to go to purgatory to do some reparation for him. So the king of Italy at risk of being taken a prisoner and trying to flee. I cannot say it well. It seemed that he was falling into the hands of his enemies, which he did. All the rich were undergoing grave dangers and some were dying. If you remember the French Revolution, it was the poor against the rich. Mm. Yeah. And you see, if it gets to that kind of stage, it's usually very vicious, you know. That which was most sorrowful is that among the leaders of the revolutions, also against the church, were priests. Now, why would that be? That they would have fallen already for Freemasonry or Marxist communism, you know. Because see, Marxist communism was atheistic materialism was foisted on the world by the French Revolution. Okay. And then by the 1900s, then it turned into Marxist communism. Okay. And then Freemasonry was there for hundreds of years before that. And when they combined, it was deadly. So you're talking about perverted clergy. Another piece of language for that, of course, is Judas's. Then when things were reaching the extreme excesses, a foreign power seems to intervene. OK. And the foreign power, of course, World War I, they all get mixed up. I won't continue any further, she said. So June the 22nd, 1908, the divine will triumphs over everything. OK, this June the 22nd. This morning, Louisa said, I was feeling very oppressed because of the privation of my adorable Jesus. And I said to myself, I cannot take any more. How can I go on without my life? What patience it takes with you, Jesus. She has said that to him a number of times. What would be the power that would induce him to come? At that moment, he came and he told me, my daughter, the power that triumphs over everything, that conquers everything, that levels everything, that sweetens everything, is the will of God. It's a total solution to everything. Because it contains such power that nothing can resist it. Okay? And then he goes on to say that it transforms everything it's allowed to touch. While he was saying this, A road full of rocks, thorns and steep mountains appeared before me. So that seems to be like Isaiah 40 verses 1 to 10. Once all of this was placed in the will of God, by the power of it, the rocks were pulverized, the thorns were changed into flowers and the mountains leveled. That means that when the will of God is allowed to work with us, the rocks that are in us are pulverized, the thorns that sting are changed into flowers, and the mountains of pride and self-glory and all the rest, they're all leveled. That's the work that the divine will does in us. So in the will of God, all things have the same appearance. They all assume the same colour. So Isaiah 40 said, you know, to bring down the mountains and fill up the valleys so that the king can actually enter. Now, the king is divine will, coming to his own kingdom inside of each one of us. So she said, may his holy will be blessed. Now, between that message and the next one is June the 31st, 1908. Now, on the 30th of June, 1908, an asteroid crashed into Siberia and devastated about 2,000 square kilometres of land. If it had landed in a populated area, millions of people would have died instantly.
Siberia.
Yeah, you can check this on the internet.
Yeah, picture of it one night on that black and white pictures.
Yeah. But the thing I want to tell you is, think of Louisa.
Yeah.
She is doing all of this suffering and intercession and all the rest of it, and she doesn't realise, she doesn't take into account what she has prevented from happening. Now, the Lord is going to remind her. You keep on saying that, you know, you're not getting enough. You don't realise what has you've actually provided, you know. And it's just that I just happen to have that piece of information. And it's in between these two messages where she has seen the wars and the revolutions and everything else. And
her intercession, maybe, isn't it?
Yeah. But also her sufferings.
Okay.
You see, it's not just her prayers. Prayers without sufferings haven't got too much value. It's called hot air. and very...
Prayers don't define me now.
No, I didn't say that.
No,
I said,
I
said something very specific. Prayers without sufferings have very little value. It's very easy to say Hail Mary and you don't give a tuppenny damn about the people.
Yes.
I get so upset at Sunday Mass that I have to try and shut off from it. They say all kinds of prayers. Lord, hear us. Lord, graciously hear us. Lord, hear us. Lord, graciously hear us. And they're not going to do a thing about anything they're saying. And they're making the most wonderful prayers. I said, but it's only hot air. Whereas if you were prepared to fast and pray and do something about it, and then you say the exact same prayer, it would change things. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So it has to be, there's a huge difference between something that simply comes from the lips and something that comes from your innermost being. Now, Louisa was praying from her innermost being. She was suffering the passion. And if she wasn't suffering that, she was suffering this martyrdom of the privation of Jesus. And she was offering it all. And I think that was one of the results. Because he tells her after a while, you don't seem to take into account what you have prevented from happening. Because that asteroid, if it had hit London, would have destroyed everything in sight. Just to give one example that's close by. Okay, so June the 31st, 1908, we're going to talk about love and we're going to talk about the rich and the poor again. So that Luke 16, 19 to 31, Dives and Lazarus, rich man, poor man. I want to give you Matthew 26, 11. I want to give you 2 Corinthians 8, 9. So it's about the true spirit of charity. In other words, you can hand out money and there's no charity. Continuing in my usual state, full of bitterness and of privations, after much hardship, I seem to see people in the act of rebelling and of intensifying the brawl against the rich. In the meantime, The lament of most sweet Jesus made itself heard in my ear, all embittered, saying, I am the one who is giving freedom to the poor. I'm tired of the rich. In other words, I'm allowing the poor to rebel. They have done enough. How much money are wasted on balls, on theatricals, on useless trips, on vanities, and even on sins? Oh, boys, wouldn't that condemn an awful lot of people? Mm-hmm. So I want to give you Luke 14:13. And Luke 18 from verse 22. You see, modern society thinks you should be wasting your money on balls and theatricals and useless trips and pagan festivals in honour of a saint and everything. And the poor, he said, they could not have enough bread to satisfy their hunger. They were oppressed, weary and embittered. Had they given them only, if the rich had given them only what they spent on unnecessary things, my poor would have been happy. That's exactly the story of Dives and Lazarus, the scraps at the rich man's table. But the rich have kept them like a family who did not belong to them, and even more, they've despised them, keeping comforts and amusements for themselves as things befitting their condition, and leaving the poor in misery as something befitting their condition. Okay, so I want to give you Galatians 2:10. And I want to give you the letter of James, chapter 2, verses 1 to 13. Because I gave you James 5 before.
James, sorry. James.
2, 1 to 13. There's an awful lot in the New Testament about the rich and the poor. So while saying this, Jesus seemed to withdraw grace from the poor. What's that grace? It's the grace of Lazarus to be able to put up with it and still trust in God and die in poverty. Okay, that's the grace. He seemed to withdraw grace from the poor, and these would become enraged against the rich. That's exactly what happened in the French Revolution, in such a way that grave things would happen. On seeing this, Louisa said, my dear life and my all good. It's true that there are some bad rich people, but there are also some good ones. Oh, watch this now. She's throwing herself unknowingly from the frying pan into the fire. Okay. Like the many devout ladies who give alms in the churches and the priests who do good for all. Oh, Lord, will you hear Jesus' response? Mm-hmm. It won't be good for you to hear his response. Ah, my daughter, he said, keep quiet and don't touch this key so very sorrowful to me. I could say that I do not recognize these devout ladies. Whoops. Matthew 7:21-23. Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and work mighty miracles in your name? And he said, I don't even know you. Okay. What are these devout ladies doing? They give alms where they want to obtain their intent and to hold people at their service. Whoops, wrong motivation. They spend even thousands of lire for those who sympathize with them. And then where it is necessary, they do not deign to give a cent. Could I say that they do it for me? Could I recognize these actions of theirs? You yourself can recognize whether they do it for me from these signs. If they are ready for any bare necessity, okay? Sorry, if they are ready for any bare necessity, they do not differentiate by giving much where it is not necessary and refusing to give little where it is necessary. One can say that there's no spirit of true charity. Now, this is the 8th volume you've read, okay? So you know for absolute certain that Jesus says, if your actions are not done out of love for him, they've no value. They're not recognized. Forget about it. You can give 3 million and it doesn't mean a thing to him. But if you give the widow's mite out of pure love, yeah, he'll look at it. Okay. So he says there's no spirit of true charity or upright operating or working there. So my poor are put into oblivion also by these devout ladies. I wouldn't like to have been one of them devout ladies, would you? So now what about the priests? Oh, holy God. Ah, my daughter. That's even worse, he said. They do good to all. That's what Louisa had said up above, you see. You deceive yourself. They do good to the rich. They've time for the rich. By them also, the poor are almost excluded. For the poor, they've no time. For the poor, they've not a word of comfort or help to tell them. They send them away, reaching the point of pretending they're ill. I could say that if the poor have moved away from the sacraments, the priests have contributed to this. Oh, my goodness. Because they've always taken their time to confess them. In other words, they don't want to hear their confessions. That's James chapter 2, verses 1 to 9. Nearly verbatim. And the poor grew tired, and so they didn't come back. But then, if a rich person should show up, oops, that's James 5:5. Literally, James 5:5. But if a rich person would show up, oh, it's all the opposite. They wouldn't hesitate one instant. Time, words, comforts, help. They would find anything for the rich. Could I say that the priests have a spirit of true charity if they reach the point of picking the ones to whom they should listen? And what about the others? They either send them somewhere else or oppress them so much that if my grace did not help the poor in a special way, the poor would have been banished from my church. Isn't that something else? True charity and upright spirit only rarely do some priests have them. Isn't that absolutely scary? But as for the rest, I'd say that these have departed from the earth. So Louisa wasn't impressed by that. So let's come to, that's quite something, isn't it? Also, it's very frightening. Yeah. Because you're being told so clearly that if the right motivation isn't there, forget about it. God doesn't want to know. God doesn't want, and it can appear that you are doing the right thing, but it's not. The appearance isn't right. Okay, so July the 26th, 1908, is just a sentence or two. Louisa said, Jesus told her, "My daughter, obedience is the ark of my dwelling in the soul. Where this ark of obedience is not present, I can say there's no place for me in that soul and I'm forced to remain outside." So if we're doing our own will, if we're doing self-will, there's no room for him. It's actually quite simple. So August the 10th, 1908, we come back again to love. He keeps coming back because this is a central point. And I want to give you a little heading for it. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. You know it, don't you? Continuing my usual state, but full of bitterness and of privations, after I received communion, I was lamenting to Blessed Jesus about the way he had left me and about the uselessness of my state. And he, having compassion on my laments, told me, "My daughter, nothing has diminished the goods that exist between you and me, because the whole of good is in its origin, the origin of its foundation." Okay, so it's where it started from that makes something really good or not good. We would say if the roots are rotten, forget about the plant. If the roots are healthy, you'll have a healthy plant. So the origin of the relationship between Louisa and Jesus is the divine will. When two persons unite themselves with a bond of friendship or with the bond of marriage, and they've exchanged gifts besides, and have loved each other so much as to become inseparable to the extent that one has taken and copied the other so much as to feel the being of the beloved within herself. If out of bare necessity they have they are forced to be away from each other. Are these gifts perhaps diminished, or does their love decrease? Not at all. On the contrary, being far away makes them grow more in love. That's why I gave you the heading. And makes them keep the gifts received with greater care, waiting for some greater unexpected gift at the return of the other one. But there's more. Since one has copied her beloved within herself, this is talking about the Lord and the soul, it seems that there's no distance for her, because she feels the voice of the beloved flow within her voice, having imitated him. She feels him flow in her mind, in her works, and in her steps. This is one of the prayers we have in the Divine Will, that the Divine Will would flow in your mind and in your voice and absolutely everything. So he is far, but he is near. She looks at him and he escapes her. He touches her, but she can't grasp him. That's John 20. Do you remember Mary of Magdala? Verses 1 to 20, 1 to 10. So she clung to his feet and he said, no, don't cling. So she touches him but cannot clasp him. Therefore, the soul is in continuous martyrdom of love, reaching out, and yet you can't grasp. And that's only while we're on earth. Now, if justice forces me to deprive you of me and to be far away for some time, now he's been telling her this for 8 volumes, can you say that I have taken the gifts away from you and that there's a diminution of love? And Louisa doesn't answer that, and she says, Lord, my state is too difficult, my dear life. And what am I here if you do not let me suffer to spare my neighbour the chastisements? You've said many times that you would not allow rain, and it's not raining. So I cannot beat you in anything. Look at the problem. Whatever you say, you do. While if I had you near me like before, I would tell you so much that you would let me win. Now, this is the problem, and it's very, very interesting. It's the problem of the victim soul. That if he stays away from her and leaves her in the agony of the privations, she's not in a position to be able to get round him, to give her the sufferings and therefore to mitigate the chastisements. Mm-hmm. She calls that winning. And if he stays away and leaves her in this agony, as we've been reading for the past couple of messages, then it means he wins, because he says, I'll do this and you do it. I just love the way she says it. I think it's beautiful, you know. She said, how can you say that distance is nothing? You know. She's not agreeing with him at all. And so he said, it's precisely because of this that I am forced to be far away, so as not to let you win and to give course to justice. However, by keeping you here, there is also some good, because the lack of water will call for famine. And during this time, the people will be humiliated. And after the slaughters and the wars have taken place, grace will find them more disposed to be saved. Is this not also a good? And while wars were about to overtake the famine, by keeping you here, it will be postponed a little longer and more souls will be saved. He does win, and he knows how to win, doesn't he? Okay. Go back to the line where it says, during the famine, people will have to be humiliated and they might grow. Beside that, put Isaiah chapter 2, verses 7, 9 and 11. That's where Isaiah says that the pride of man has to be brought low if God is to be able to work. Because pride is the big barrier between us and God. And then he added, love never says enough. Even if love scourged the soul and tore her to pieces, those pieces would cry out, love. Love never says enough. It's not yet content. It pulverizes those pieces. It reduces them to nothing. And in that nothing, it blows its fire and gives its own shape. It mixes nothing human, but only divine. You see, the Lord has to bring down our pride into nothingness, okay? And it's only with the nothingness that he can work, because he won't mix the human with the divine. It just doesn't mix. It's like iron and water won't mix. And it's then that love sings its glories, its braveries and its prodigies, saying, I am content, my love has won. It has destroyed the human and built the divine. That is what is going on. And the Lord says that is the incredible mystery that's going on inside of each one of us, that the human has to be brought down so that the divine can be built up. And when the human has truly been brought down into nothingness and the divine therefore has taken over, then the divine will has won, but also love has won, and the person is completely redeemed. And Jesus says in higher volumes that once the will has been given to him, nothing more will be asked, because there is nothing else to give. Your will is your highest gift. So he says, it happens to love as to a talented artisan who, having many objects which are not to his liking, he breaks them to pieces, puts them on the fire and keeps them there until they melt, making them lose all their shape. Think of Jeremiah and the potter in Jeremiah 18, verses 1 to 12. Or think of me making candles, and if I don't like the candle, then you just melt it down and you start all over again. Okay. So you put them back on the fire and they lose their shape, and then he forms from them other objects which are most beautiful and pleasant, worthy of his talent. It is true that for that which is human, this action of love is so very hard. Now, love is a capital L, 1 John 4:7. God is love. And I also want to give you Psalm 145:17. God can only act out of love, because that's what he is. And yet this action of love, which pulverizes what is human in us to let the divine take over, seems very, very hard, like almost like torture, martyrdom.
Was that John? No, it was in John
1:4. 1 John 4:7, God is love.
Yes, I know that.
So this action of love seems so very hard, but when the soul sees her gain, she will see how beauty has taken the place of ugliness, richness of poverty, nobility of roughness, and she too will sing the glories of love. So when will we sing the glories of love? I think only in heaven, because it's only then that we'll really see. Okay. So August the 14th, 1908, this is about the divine image. Having received communion, I could see the baby within my interior, as though looking for something important. And I said, my pretty little one, what are you looking for with so much zeal? And he said, daughter, and I love that she sees him as an infant and he calls her daughter, okay? Daughter, I am looking for the brush of your will, to be able to portray my image, Romans 8:29, to be able to portray my image in your heart. In fact, if you do not give me your will, now Louisa has long since given her will to him. This message is for us, okay? If you do not give me your will, I lack the brush to be able to portray myself. Now, I need to give you Ephesians 2:10, because he's thinking of himself as a painter, okay? And Ephesians 2:10 says, you're God's work of art created in Christ Jesus, okay? So if you don't give me your will, he said, I lack the brush to be able to portray myself freely in you. And just as your will serves as a brush in my hands, love serves as colours, in order to impress the variety of colours of my image. Now, the colours are all the divine attributes, love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and all the rest of it. That's Galatians 5:20. Moreover, just as the human will serves as brush for me, My will serves as a brush in the hands of the soul in order to portray her image in my heart. Isn't that something else? In me, then, she will find abundant colour of love for the variety of colours. That's all the work you do in the divine will. Isn't that fantastic? So, August the 19th, 1908. The soul must sow good with her whole being. So for that, I want to give you 2 Corinthians 9, 6. 2 Corinthians 9, 6. And Galatians 6, 7 to 8. So having done my meditation on the fact that one who sows good will harvest good, and one who sows vices will harvest evils, I was thinking about what good I could sow, given my position, my misery, and my inability. At that moment, I felt I was being harvested, and I heard Jesus say in my interior, "The soul must sow good with her whole being, with all of it." The soul possesses a mental intelligence, and she must apply it to understand God. To think of good alone, never allowing any bad seed to enter her mind. 2 Corinthians 10, 5. 2 Corinthians 10, 5 and Proverbs 23, 7. Proverbs 23, 7. So the Lord said that we possess a mental intelligence and we must apply this to understanding God. And think of good alone and never allowing any bad seed to enter the mind. And this is the sowing of good in the mind. That's number one. So number two, it's the same with her mouth. She must never sow any bad seed, that is bad words, unworthy of a Christian. But always say holy, useful and good words. So here is the sowing of good in the mouth. Now, I can't give you references for that. I just want to say to you, there are 50 proverbs on the tongue alone in the book of Proverbs. There's 50 of them. And one of them says, there's life and death in the power of the tongue, and those who eat it must eat the fruit thereof. So 50 proverbs on the tongue alone. So number three, then with her heart, he said, she must love God alone. That's Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. You know that one off by heart now, don't you? And it's also, that's Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. And it's also Matthew 22. Matthew 22, verses 23 to 34. Sorry, to 24. 23 to 24. So with her heart, she must love God alone, desire God, palpitate for him and tend towards him. Here is the sowing of good with the heart. Then with her hands, she must do holy works. With her feet, she must walk after the examples of our Lord and so on. On hearing this, I thought to myself, so in my position, I too can, that my position being I'm sitting here in bed and I can't do anything. I too can sow good seed in spite of my extreme misery. But I thought of this with a certain fear on the account that the master would ask of me, that's in judgment, whether I have sown well. And in my interior, I heard Jesus repeat, "My goodness is so great that great wrong is done by those who make me known as severe, very demanding and rigorous." Now, the God who is severe, demanding and rigorous is the God of Sinai. Will you write that beside it? The God of Sinai. And the reason why the God of Sinai had to be severe, demanding and rigorous is that he had to make a people and he had to try and get them from an absolutely pagan way of life into living a disciplined life on his commandments. And if you would like to do that with Ireland today, you'd know Moses' difficulty. It was total miracle stuff to get an entire nation to turn around and live a completely new way of life. So that's why he had to be severe and demanding with the commandments. But Jesus came all merciful love. So it's wrong for us to say that he's demanding and severe, because he actually paid the price for everything for us. Okay, so what an affront they give to my love. That's Jesus incarnate. I will ask for no other account but of the little field given to them. And I will ask for an account of nothing but to give them the fruit of their harvest. In other words, he wants to see what you have sown so he can give you the harvest. I will give it to the intelligence, for the more it has understood me in life, the more it will understand me in heaven. That is a very, very important point. That's why the more we study these writings of Louisa and the more we read the scriptures, you enter heaven at a much deeper level than anybody else. Because the more you understand him on entering heaven, the further on you are. You see, there are souls who are dying and they're not ready at all. They've probably not read a scripture in their lives. They probably don't know him at all. And from the way you hear people talking nowadays, you realise they know nothing about God. They don't know what he's like. And so when they go to the other side, they've got to start at wrong again. They don't know him. And so they're being judged by someone they actually don't know, which is really sad. Whereas we will go to him in love, and it is love that will be judging us. So if love meets love, you don't have a problem. And since fire is the image of love, fire is the image of God, and fire is the image of judgment, then a spark leaps into the fire. St. Therese of Lisieux was asked, would she be afraid of God's judgment? And she said, afraid? She said, I'll be sitting on his knee when he's judging the earth. He's my dad. You see, it's the difference between someone who knows him and someone who doesn't. The judging the earth thing is the people who are far out there and therefore are not responding in any love towards him. And so here's Jesus saying, no, I will want to give you your harvest. So the more you understand me in life, he said, the more you will understand me in heaven. And the more the soul will understand me, the greater the joy and beatitude with which they will be inundated. I want to give you the book of Daniel, chapter 12, 1 to 3, where he says that the holy people will shine like stars in the presence of God. So to the mouth, he said, I will give the harvest of the different divine flavors, and its voice will harmonize above all the other blessed. To the works I will give the harvest of my gifts, and so on with all the rest. So he's begging us not to misinterpret who he is. So the next one is about discernment. This is August the 23rd, 1908. Continuing in my usual state, I was very concerned about the state of my soul. She's back to it again. And I said to myself, who knows what evil there is in my soul that the Lord deprives me of him and leaves me abandoned. Now, she knows why he's not coming. At that moment, Jesus came for just a little and filled all of myself with him, and my whole being was all directed to him. Now, notice that he comes and he just absolutely takes her into his love so that everything is enveloped in love. There was not even a fibre or emotion that would not tend towards him, she said. Then afterwards he told me, have you seen my daughter? The sign that there is guilt in the soul when she finds herself without me is that as I return to let myself be seen, she does not remain all filled with God. Now, Louisa could not have been enveloped completely by love if she had moved away from love. Doesn't that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the fact that as soon as he returned, she was able to be completely absorbed in his love says that she hadn't moved. The problem with us is that we can move away from the Lord because we're affected so much by worldly influence. And the worst influence we have is the television and what comes to us from mobile phones. I think it's the worst of all. Absolutely worldly thinking and pulling you away from God completely. So I think that the more we go into divine will, the more control we have to take over the black box. So he said, the sign by which the guilt of the soul would be is that she doesn't remain in her God, nor is her being immediately disposed to immerse herself completely in me in such a way that not a fibre would be left which is not fixed in her Creator. Where there is guilt or something that is not completely mine, neither can I fill her. So he's telling Louisa, listen, nothing has changed between you and me. Nor can the soul immerse herself in me. Guilt, matter, cannot enter into God. Would you please colour that? You should bring a colour pen every now and then. Guilt and matter cannot enter into God, nor can it run towards God. I want to give you two references there. One that you should know off by heart now, Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. And I want to give you Isaiah 35, verses 8 to 10. There Isaiah is talking about the highway to God, and he said only the redeemed will walk on it, the unclean won't be on that path. Okay, so let me give you another one. This is August the 26th, 1908, and it's talking about constancy. As I was in my usual state, I was all afflicted and almost dazed because of the usual privations. And then Jesus came just in passing, and he told me, my daughter, that which I want you to take to heart is constancy in good. That means that you continue day after day after day after day after day, both internal and external, because the repetition of the act of loving me, of many interior acts and of constant good makes divine life grow ever more in the soul. Now, please, please put an NB beside that. Make a big mark. Make sure you see it. It's one of the gems. Let me read it again. The repetition of the act of loving me, of many interior acts, and of constant good is what makes divine life grow ever more in the soul. So you know how to do it. But with such energy that she can be compared to a child who, growing in good air and with healthy foods, keeps growing well in full health until he reaches his proper stature without needing either doctors or medicines. Even more, he's so robust and strong that he relieves and helps others. So in other words, full spiritual health here. On the other hand, one who is not constant grows like a child who's not always fed with healthy foods and lives in putrid air. He grows sickly, and since his members do not have the strength to develop and grow due to the lack of good nourishment, they develop with defects. And so a tumour forms in one place and an abscess in another. Isn't that rather interesting? Here's a medical diagnosis you weren't expecting.
No.
He walks with a limp. He speaks with difficulty. And one can say that he's a poor cripple. Though one can see good members mixed in, those with defects are more. And even though he consults doctors and takes medicines, they do him little good because his blood is infected by the putrid air. The one thing they didn't look at. And his members are weak and defective from malnutrition. Gosh, we have millions of children like that today, haven't we?
Yeah.
So he will be a man, but he will not reach proper stature and will always need help without being able to help others. Such is the inconstant soul. Now, what was wrong with this child? First of all, wasn't properly fed. So if we're not feeding on the Lord's messages, and we're not feeding on prayer, and we're not feeding on the scriptures, and not feeding on the Eucharist, we're responsible for our malnutrition. Okay. The other is the putrid air. And the putrid air for me spiritually is that you're breathing the air of worldliness. You see, the problem with Abraham's nephew Lot was that he liked Sodom and Gomorrah. He wanted to benefit from the life that was there. They were rich. They had all kinds of luxuries and all the rest of it. And he was living on the edge of it. No, he wasn't right in the centre of it. But he was benefiting from it. And so when the angels came to try and get him and his wife and children out of the place, the wife turned back. Many people do that. They want to be Christian, but they want all the benefits of the world as well. I think that's one of the great sicknesses in the church today. There's no detachment from the world. The early Christians knew that they were the very special people of God, and they were living a heavenly life on earth, and they were able to change the earth into a heavenly place. Now the world has invaded and evangelized us, and we have become worldly and sick. Okay, that's, to me, that's the putrid air. Such is the inconstant soul. With inconstancy in good, it is as if the soul nourished herself with foods that are not good, and by applying herself to other things which are not God, it is as if she breathed putrid air. So divine life grows with difficulty and purely because it lacks the strength and the vigour of constancy. So I'm going to leave it there for tonight.